The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. Insurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 23, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Up at the top right-hand corner is that little thumbprint page-turning space that says our 100th year. Time is in a dull grayish-brown color in large capital block letters, superimposed upon a darker brown-gray gradiated background. The background is a wall of a room, in front of which is seated a girl, Gloria, 13. She's either on a divan or a bed. It has a rather dull floral print. Behind her on the wall is an electrical outlet. To the side of the surface upon which she is seated, one sees a portion of a brown wood table. Gloria has dark brown eyes, a tan skin, very long black hair beyond her shoulders. She's wearing, although she's seated with her legs curled under her, she's wearing a dress. It's white with some red embroidery motif and has fringe, white fringe at the hem. She's also wearing several beaded bracelets on her right wrist. Beginning now with From the Editor by Sam Jacobs, Editor-in-Chief. The Wisdom of Youth. In the wake of Mahsa Jina Amini's death, Iranian chess master Sarah Ghadem defied her country's mandatory dress regulations during competition. Indian YouTuber Dhruv Rathi is facing threats for fact-checking trending topics on Indian social media for millions of his followers. Jonathan Hayward recently became the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's first music director of color, and at 31, the youngest current music director of any major U.S. orchestra. These are three of the individuals profiled in this fall's class of next-generation leaders. The 9-year-old franchise, made possible by our partnership with Rolex. Their stories continue to reshape for us what leadership can be. Through next-generation leaders, we explore influence in many forms, including artistry, athleticism, and activism. And we examine rising leaders breaking barriers in traditional realms of power like politics. Representing this fall's group on the cover is First Minister of Scotland, Humza Yousaf, who's earned himself a growing series of firsts. Again, this is not the cover photo I just described to you. This is apparently an inside cover photo. At 27, he became the youngest member of the Scottish Parliament to join the Scottish government. Now 38, he's the first Muslim politician to lead a Western democracy, as well as the first non-white and youngest first minister of his country. Yousaf is leading at a moment of competing crises, scandal hitting his Scottish National Party, and significant increases in the cost of living, to name just two. He knows that his identity matters to voters and to history. He says of seeing his portrait hung at Bute House, the official residence of the First Minister, "I really stand out because I look different. It was really emotional." I remember looking at it and thinking, almost whatever happens now, mine will always be the one that looks different. We look forward to taking next generation leaders into its second decade next year. In this issue, we also explore the youth mental health crisis through a project for which photographer Robin Hammond met 48 young people, ages 11 to 17, living across the U.S. The data on the state of U.S. children and mental health are stark. In 2021, following the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, more than one in five American high schoolers reported seriously considering suicide, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. These kids and teenagers, including two who are featured on accompanying covers, talk to Hammond about their experiences with gun violence, bullying, social media, gender identity, and more. We publish Hammond's work, which was supported by Witness Change and Youth Empowerment Group, along with selections from these conversations, in an effort to give kids an opportunity to speak openly about their experiences. My job was to listen to teenagers talk about the challenges they face, Hammond says, but I could not help but listen as a father of a kid about to enter school in a scary world. What these kids taught me, I should not rush to solve all my child's problems. What she may need most is someone to listen, really listen, not offer advice, not to fix, but to hear her, and let her know that I'm always here to truly hear her, and sometimes do nothing more than that. These stories are powerful, they're insightful, but for me, they're also lessons on how to be a better parent. Beginning first with a captioned photograph, it is a maelstrom. It looks like greenish, bluish, whitish, grayish water with waves peaking. And several people are standing in it. There are three groups, perhaps they're family groups. Maybe the caption will say, migrants in clusters that include both adults and children lock hands as they wade across the Rio Grande, September 27, from Mexico to Eagle Pass, Texas, where the mayor declared a state of emergency. Some 210,000 people crossed the southern border unlawfully in September, the third highest monthly total on record, after 224,000 in May 2022 and 222,000 in December. From the bulletin, written by Simone Shaw, the British Museum is asking for help finding missing artifacts. The British Museum in London, frequently accused of displaying looted treasures, has solicited the public's help in finding artifacts stolen from its collection over the years. Of some 2,000 items first reported missing in August and valued in the millions of pounds, 60 had been returned to the museum by late September, and 300 more were in the process of retrieval. The missing artifacts, which were not on public display, are dated from the 15th century BC to the 19th century and include gold, jewelry, and semi-precious gemstones. The museum is working with the Art Loss Register, the world's largest database of stolen art, and has established an email hotline for anyone with information to come forward. Some items were being sold on the e-commerce platform eBay, including one Roman artifact valued at over £50,000 and offered on the platform for £40. The museum does not have a full catalog of all the items in its collection of more than 8 million artifacts, which may be why losses went unnoticed for so long. The thefts are under investigation by London police. The museum's previous director resigned from his role in August after it was revealed an antique dealer reportedly notified the museum of the thefts in 2021, but little action was taken. a senior curator for the museum, was fired and has been accused of selling the artifacts online, though his family has denied any wrongdoing. Accusations about the museum's handling of artifacts and the practices through which it acquired them have been thrust into the spotlight. Several countries, including Greece, Nigeria, and China, are calling for the museum to repatriate the holdings to the country of origin. While the museum claims to have a higher standard of care for the artifacts than the countries they were taken from, said Greece's culture minister, Lena Mendoni, the unprecedented case of the theft of hundreds of valuable objects of the British Museum, with perpetrators appointed to protect its collections, in addition to criminal and moral responsibilities, raises the major question of the credibility of the museum organization itself. Politics within the brief news. This is by Nick Popley, or Popley, P-O-P-L-I. After McCarthy, a house in disarray. A small photo here. In color, a former Speaker McCarthy, dressed in dark blue, light blue, and a purple tie at the U.S. Capitol after his ouster October 3. He's standing in front of a wood-paneled wall with three U.S. flags at his right side. When asked the advice he would give the next Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy replied, "Change the rules." The California Republican was addressing the press October 3, the day he lost the job he had held for only 10 months, a decent run for an Italian government, but a mortifyingly brief interval to hold a position that draws power from longevity. The marble edifices of the Capitol campus that surrounded McCarthy as he spoke are named for how speakers like Joe Cannon, Nicholas Longworth, Sam Rayburn, whose grip on the gavel spanned decades. McCarthy held it for 38 weeks. But then the majorities managed by those leaders, two Republicans and a Democrat, were elected when parties, not insurgents, ran politics. For McCarthy, and even more so for his successor, the brutal truth was that the rules have already changed. The specific bylaw that McCarthy alluded to is one allowing any member of the Republican conference to call for a vote to recall the speaker at any time. It is a rule McCarthy agreed to in January in the course of being elected, after 15 ballots by a margin of 4 votes. The recall option was the price the former Bakersfield sandwich shop owner paid to win the support of the very far right-wing House members who deposed him 10 months later. But it signaled a larger change, away from governing toward performance. "My fear is the institution fell today," McCarthy said at his farewell press conference following the 216-210 vote. 8 Republicans joined the Democrats in voting against him. As punishment for McCarthy's agreeing with Democrats 3 days earlier on a compromise bill that kept the federal government running just hours before it was to shut down. "They don't get to say they're conservative because they're angry and chaotic," McCarthy said. He singled out Representative Matt Gaetz, flamboyant Florida Republican, who had toyed with McCarthy through the roll calls of January and invoked the rule calling for his removal. "It was all about getting attention," McCarthy said. Yet the next speaker will inherit a house that's not only divided but subdivided, with the GOP's narrow 9-seat majority diminished by an angry split between establishment Republicans and the far-right populist faction egged on by Donald Trump. Add to that a broken power structure that allows even a handful of dissenting members to wield significant influence, and the new dynamic raises concerns whether anyone can lead the House on critical issues. Being speaker is never an easy job, says Representative Mike Lawler, a New York Republican. The question now is, can someone build consensus and move us forward? A speaker of the House had never been stripped of the gavel before McCarthy. Only two others had faced a motion to vacate threat to their leadership position, neither of which succeeded, once in 1910 and more recently in 2015. The Republican Party is in real danger, says Larry Sabato, a political analyst and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. They're not going to get very much done in the coming months without a long-term game plan. One of the most contentious issues facing the House is Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky met with President Joe Biden in September and pleaded for new weapons systems, including F-16 fighter jets and longer-range ATACMS missiles. And the White House is asking Congress for $20.6 billion. A small group of House Republicans are vehemently opposed to military aid for Kyiv and have threatened to tank any legislation that would provide it. House Republicans also disagree on how to conduct their impeachment inquiry into Biden over his family's business dealings. McCarthy named Oversight Committee Chair James Comer, a Kentucky Republican, to lead the inquiry under pressure from the far right. Lawmakers may now push to remove him from the investigation. Perhaps most consequential for everyday Americans, the government will shut down if the Republican-led House and Democratic-led Senate fail to reach an agreement to pass 12 annual spending bills by November 17. This was a difficult job for Kevin McCarthy, says Laura Blessing, a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University, but it is now a far more difficult job for someone else. From the Milestones page, died, we have 2, 4, 6 categories here, and the first died is almost, not quite, almost, let's say, 7/8 of a page. Dianne Feinstein. It's written by Philip Elliott. There's a black and white photo of Feinstein. Goodness, from decades ago. She has short brown hair, a huge smile. She's surrounded by a crowd, but she's got the camera. She's wearing larger pearl earrings and a large pearl necklace. We see only the shoulders, and she's wearing probably what is a cream-colored outfit. This is a black-and-white photo. Died Dianne Feinstein, the lioness of the Senate. In her prime, no one rivaled Dianne Feinstein, the veteran lawmaker who defied both label and party orthodoxy during decades at the heart of some of the nation's defining moments. She knew what it was like to lose. Even before arriving in Washington, the Democrat had 2 failed bids for San Francisco mayor and 1 for California governor under her belt, not to mention the trauma of finding her friends immediately after a former colleague assassinated them in San Francisco City Hall back in 1978. The losses informed her need to make wins count all the more, and did she ever win? Feinstein, the longest-serving woman in the Senate, died September 29 at the age of 90 as the upper chamber's oldest member. Her health in recent months generated plenty of chatter about overstaying one's welcome. Hospitalized in February with shingles that later turned out to include encephalitis, she was dogged by concerns about her ability to do her job, but Feinstein refused to step down. Born Diane Goldman in 1933, the oldest of 3 daughters unfurled policy ambitions that were as unapologetic as they were sincere. Gun safety, the HIV/AIDS epidemic, government transparency, gender equity, LGBTQ rights. All were set on new courses because of the dictates of Feinstein, who in 1984 was on the short list for the vice presidency. Shortly after her arrival in Washington in 1993, then-Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joe Biden recruited Feinstein to join his panel, where she became the top Democrat and watched 8 of the 9 current Supreme Court justices rise to the bench. From her post on the powerful Senate Intelligence Panel, she guided decades of U.S. policy. She proved a hawkish defender of U.S. spycraft and a brief apologist for George W. Bush's war on terrorism. Later, she declassified a summary of a report on CIA torture programs over the objections of the agency and Barack Obama. And in her later years, her work on judiciary drew enmity for seeming out of step with her party's opposition to Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominees. Feinstein may have carried herself with a regal demeanor, but her true self was the one who cornered colleagues in basement hallways and hosted dinners for friends across the aisle. She never stopped looking for a deal, and seldom came into any meeting without something she was willing to trade away in service of a bigger get. If the late Edward M. Kennedy was a lion of the Senate, Feinstein was its lioness, but not one who followed the pride after all. That is not true leadership. Another dyed entry with a small photograph in color. It looks like a silvery dressed wizard. This man has a long white beard. He has his hands clasped in front of him, and he's wearing a gray tasseled cap. Michael Gambon, who played Dumbledore in 6 of the 8 Harry Potter films, died at 82, September 27. Suggested potential ways for Catholic priests to bless same-sex unions, with major caveats, by Pope Francis in a July letter the Vatican published October 3, warned people in France about a widespread outbreak of bedbugs in Paris by the government. No one is safe, the city's deputy mayor said on X on September 29. Arrested Dwayne Keith Davis for murder, September 29. Prosecutors say he ordered the 1996 killing of rapper Tupac Shakur. Won, the Nobel Prize in Medicine by two scientists, Katalin Karikó and Drew Weissman, October 2, for their research on mRNA, critical to developing COVID-19 vaccines. Appointed Emily's List president, LaPhonza, that's LaPhonza Butler, by California Governor Gavin Newsom to complete Dianne Feinstein's Senate term. The Brief News, Good Question, by Andrew R. Chow. What can we expect from Sam Bankman-Fried's trial? Bankman-Fried is hyphenated. There's a photo here. It's blurry, perhaps intentionally. Bankman-Fried at Manhattan Federal Court, August 11. A young man, we see only the head and the shoulders. He's wearing a dark suit or jacket, white shirt, striped tie. He has rather fluffy, dark brown or black hair. He is not looking at the camera. And between him and the camera lens, it appears to be a transparent shower curtain. It's not really blurry, but it is definitely not a clear photograph from the camera's lens of Bankman-Fried. Last September, Sam Bankman-Fried was described on CNBC as the Michael Jordan of crypto. Just over a year later, the founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, is on trial in federal court in Manhattan in one of the most anticipated criminal proceedings of the year. FTX was a crypto exchange that allowed its users to buy, sell, and hold cryptocurrencies and use financial mechanisms to bet on those tokens' price movements. It collapsed in November 2022 following a rush of withdrawals, with the exchange unable to account for billions of dollars in customer funds. Upon filing for bankruptcy, FTX owed its top 50 creditors alone $3.1 billion. Federal prosecutors charged Bankman-Fried with fraud, conspiracy to commit money laundering, and several other counts. Bankman-Fried, who's pleaded not guilty to all charges, told Congress in a February 2022 hearing that as a general principle, FTX segregates customer assets from its own assets across our platforms. But prosecutors allege that instead of keeping customer funds siloed, FTX officials lent those deposits to Alameda Research, Bankman-Fried's hedge fund, at the founder's direction. Prosecutors allege first, Bankman-Fried oversaw a technical backdoor that allowed him to funnel money out of FTX customer accounts undetected, and second, that he then used those funds to buy luxury real estate, donate to political campaigns, and repay Alameda's lenders. In the trial's opening arguments October 4, Bankman-Fried's lawyers said he had a good faith belief that the way FTX and Alameda handled customer funds was permitted, and that the relationship between the two companies was reasonable under the circumstances. A separate trial scheduled for March 2024 will include all allegations of campaign finance violations. In order to convict Bankman-Fried, prosecutors will have to establish intent to prove he willfully lied and misled investors. Furthermore, they must prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, a higher standard than in civil cases, and a jury would need to reach a unanimous verdict for a conviction. Intent is the entire name of the game, and it's maybe the most difficult element for the government to prove, says Tim Howard, a partner at the law firm Fresh Fields and a former federal prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Ultimately, prosecutors will want to simplify this to SBF lied to a number of different parties to get their money. Prosecutors have accumulated more than 6 million pages of documents and other records, amounting to one of the largest ever collections of evidence in a white-collar securities fraud case. They plan to introduce about 1,300 exhibits at the trial. In addition to documents, the in-person testimony of Bankman-Fried's closest friends and collaborators will be crucial to the trial's outcome. Cooperating witnesses include Caroline Ellison, who ran Alameda Research and dated Bankman-Fried, as well as FTX executives Gary Wang and Nishad Singh. Bankman-Fried has acknowledged he made mistakes and inadequately managed risk at FTX, but he's accused Ellison of being an incompetent investor and of ignoring his guidance. He says he was given bad legal advice and was the victim of market forces. While one man will be on trial, the whole crypto ecosystem will be in the spotlight at a time when many in the industry are eager to move on. A number of crypto insiders have argued Bankman-Fried's alleged crimes have nothing to do with crypto at all, and he's charged with carrying out old-school fraud in the vein of Bernie Madoff, but Bankman-Fried was viewed by many as the crypto industry's American figurehead. Some are concerned about the repercussions for the entire sector. With all the public attention on the money that's been lost, Howard says, you're basically going to encourage Congress and regulators to be more aggressive against the entire ecosystem. Here's the cover story. Under the heading Health, in their own words, the unique stress of growing up right now and how young Americans are coping, by Jamie Ducharme. There are several photographs included, whose captions I will read to you. This project was produced by Witness Change and Youth Empowerment Group with the support of the WELD, W-E-L-D, Trust. Photographs and interviews by Robin Hammond. To be a U.S. teenager in 2023 is both the same as it ever was and astoundingly different from even a generation ago. Along with all the classic challenges of growing up, grades, parents, first loves, looms a crop of newer ones. TikTok, gun violence, political division, the whipsaw of COVID-19, and the not-so-slow creep of climate change. The main domains are the same, school, home, family, peers, says Dr. Asha Patton-Smith, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Kaiser Permanente in Virginia. But the stressors that emerge within those domains have changed tremendously in a world where the internet and real life have largely blurred into one, with everything from school to social interaction now happening at least partially online, and a fire hose of bad news always only a swipe away. This new world has taken a toll on U.S. teenagers, if the staggering data on adolescent mental health are any indication. In 2020, 16% of U.S. kids ages 12 to 17 had anxiety, depression, or both, a roughly 33% increase since 2016, according to an analysis by Health Policy Research Group, KFF. The following year, 42% of U.S. high school students said they felt persistently sad or hopeless. 29% reported experiencing poor mental health. 22% had seriously considered suicide. 10% had attempted suicide, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. These data are sometimes used to argue kids are not as tough as they used to be, but kids see it differently. Other generations are telling us we're a weak generation, and we haven't lived through this and that, says 16-year-old Jasmine, but we're in a new world experiencing new things. They have not experienced half of what we have experienced. It is not only big macro-level societal shifts that are having an effect. CDC data also show personal traumas like sexual violence, bullying, social isolation are concerningly common, particularly among teen girls and teens who do not identify as straight, two groups at particularly high risk for poor mental health. Of course, there's no single or simple explanation for these trends. You know, everybody's different, says 15-year-old LB. It is not just one issue around the world that can explain, oh, this is why this person's feeling this. Indeed, mental health issues are as diverse as the young people who experience them. Girls, says 14-year-old Malaya, live with unhealthy body and beauty standards, while boys are not given as much space to be sad and be emotional, says 15-year-old Josiah. Kids who identify as neither boys nor girls may be caught in a crushing gender binary that prevents self-expression, says 15-year-old Trey. And kids of color bear the tremendous weight of trauma, discrimination, and safety threats, says 17-year-old JJ. With such varied experiences, there's no one-size-fits-all cure. The most important thing adults can do is listen to teenagers, says Dr. Anish Duba, chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Council on Children, Adolescents, and Their Families. Oftentimes, the folks that are missing from the conversation are the folks that are most affected, Duba says. Young people themselves are going to have the answers more than I, as an expert, will. It is about listening to them. In an effort to do just that, photojournalist Robin Hammond interviewed dozens of U.S. teens from Georgia, Colorado, and the Washington, D.C. area about their mental health, the challenges they have faced, and how they cope. From struggles with gender identity and gun violence to bullying and body image, their words offer windows into the messy world of the U.S. teenager. But their stories also offer hope to other kids growing up in that complex environment. Jack, 15, says he's learned to overcome his anxiety by focusing on the present and has found the courage to tell kids who tease him exactly how they make him feel. Go have a one-on-one conversation and talk to them, he says. It may sound cringe. It may sound like something that you really don't want to do. But you have to trust me, from one teenager to another. It helps, and it will work. And now to Robin Hammond's photographs and the captions. Malaya, 14, Georgia. Even though they may not be as bad as what adults are dealing with, we still have problems too. Adults should not disregard our feelings because we go through things as well. They don't get to minimize our problems. Malaya looks tall here, with long braided black hair, tan skin, dark eyes, standing amongst some rose bushes. Colin, 11, Georgia, says, oh, by the way, Colin has long, shaggy hair falling into his eyes, but short in the back, and is wearing glasses and a bright yellow shirt, T-shirt. And which says, Cicada Fun Facts. Colin says, I used to feel safe at school, but the news of school shootings happening nearby kind of scared me a lot. Would my friends be safe? I'm just worried and scared this could actually happen at some point. Hugo, 13, Colorado, is wearing raggedy blue jeans, seated on a step stool, wearing an orange T-shirt with long brown hair. Everyone's just trying to figure themselves out. What worries me most is how every generation believes they're going to be the last. They do very little for the coming generations, which leads our world to destruction. No one's doing anything about climate change. Ellie, 17, Colorado, has brown eyes, and is seated in front of a dark brown backdrop and has waist-length brown hair combed in front of her, from across her shoulder into the front of her. Seated here, Ellie says, if I looked in the mirror, I'd be like, you're fat, you're ugly, you're not smart. Treat yourself the way you treat others. If you tell yourself you're beautiful, you're smart, you're strong, you will start to believe that yourself. Josiah, 15, Georgia. Here's a blurry photograph. I don't know if this has been taken from outside a window and curtains, but Josiah, from what I can see, has curly dark hair, dark eyes, and is wearing a greenish shirt. If you see somebody that's lonely, be in their life as much as you can, Josiah, 15, in Georgia, says. The girl I've been dating, we recently took a break, and we're not really sure what that means. I don't like being uncertain. I wouldn't say I'm unhappy. I wouldn't say I'm sad. I'm just confused right now. Turning the page to bullying is a self-reflection stated by Bailey, 14, of Maryland. Bailey's standing outside in a lawn full of clover, wearing a dark top and flowered pink and gray pants. The house is an off-white color. And Bailey has long black hair, a brown skin, and brown eyes. Social media does put a greater pressure on you because you look at people who have hourglass figures and big butts and all of that, but they're not going to come on there and tell you that they got plastic surgery or work done on them. Who's going to have my back for me, says Simon, 12, of Georgia. Simon looks to be shorter than some of these other photographed individuals. Short, dark hair, dark eyes. He's got a scowl on his face. He's standing in front of a gray background upon which are illustrations of Spider-Man and a couple of other action heroes. He's standing straight with his arms at his side and wearing a blue shirt, T-shirt. Simon, 12, of Georgia, says there's this group of people, like these popular kids at school, and whenever I try to join them, they're like, no, go to someone else. And I'm like, who? Who else do I have? Social media can be a bad place to be, says Abby, 15, in Colorado. Abby looks like Abby is standing in Abby's own room. It's bright yellow with bright yellow and gold floral draperies and lots of stuffed animals on a surface. Abby has long brown hair, I think. There's sunlight coming through that window that kind of obscures it. Short-sleeved t-shirt in gray and shorts in red. I wish something was different in social media. Social media should be just people connecting or showing cool things, not trying to show off what they have. Kaylee, 17, of Maryland, is standing outside next to a deck with some plants and a U.S. flag hanging over her head. She's wearing a light blue tank top and striped brown pants, long pants. She has auburn or red hair, and it, again, is combed behind her neck and over one shoulder. There's an old yellowish-looking van parked in the background. Kaylee, 17, of Maryland, says, last year I was cyberbullied and sexually harassed on an anonymous web page set up by fellow students. I tried to convince myself I was fine. I regret seeing it and not telling people right away. I should have voiced to somebody that it bothered me. And finally, August 12 of Georgia, standing in front of a pretty fancy mirror with a floral motif artwork, also behind August. August has very dark, fluffy, curly hair, tan skin, brown eyes, horizontally striped t-shirt with dark blue background and white and yellow stripes, and very dark, either dark blue or black pants. August says you can get depression from a lot of things. If a kid feels sad or depressed, I think they should talk to someone about it. That has helped me a lot. My friends ask if I'm okay, and I tell them what I'm feeling, and they help me with it. Next, The View, Society, Goodbye Columbus, by Robert P. Jones. To fully understand the deep roots of the toxic blend of ethno-religious identity politics known today as white Christian nationalism, we need to go back at least to 1493, not the year Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, but the year he returned to a hero's welcome in Spain, bringing with him gold, brightly colored parrots, and nearly a dozen captive indigenous people. The return of Columbus also precipitated one of the most fateful theological developments in the history of the Western Christian Church, the creation of what's come to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery. Established in a series of 15th century papal bulls, the doctrine claims European civilization and Western Christianity are superior to all other cultures, races, and religions. The Doctrine of Discovery merged the interests of European imperialism, including the African slave trade, with Christian missionary zeal. While the doctrine has escaped scrutiny by most white scholars and theologians, indigenous people and scholars of color have long been testifying to these Christian roots of white supremacy while dying from and living with their damaging effects. As I've continued my own journey of re-education over the past 10 years, I've come to consider the Doctrine of Discovery as a kind of Rosetta Stone for understanding the deep structure of the European political and religious worldviews we have inherited in this country. It furnished the foundational lie America was discovered and enshrined the noble innocence of pioneers in the story we white Christian Americans have told about ourselves. Ideas such as manifest destiny, America as a city on a hill, or America as a new Zion, all sprouted from the seed that was planted in 1493. This sense of divine entitlement, of European Christian chosenness, has shaped the worldview of most white Americans and thereby influenced key events, policies, and laws throughout American history. The contemporary currency of this worldview is reflected in the telling results of a 2023 Christian Nationalism Survey conducted by PRRI in partnership with the Brookings Institution, which asked, "Do you agree or disagree God intended America to be a new promised land where European Christians could create a society that could be an example to the rest of the world?" While only 3 in 10 Americans agreed, majorities of Republicans, 52%, and white evangelical Protestants, 56%, affirmed it. Moreover, the survey found among white Americans today, this belief in America as a divinely ordained white Christian nation, one that has blessed so much brutality in our history, is strongly linked to denials of structural racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Semitism, anti-LGBTQ plus sentiment, support for patriarchal gender roles, and even support for political violence. In America, a divinely ordained promised land, is America a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians, or is America a pluralistic democracy where all stand on equal footing as citizens? Most Americans embrace the latter vision, but a desperate, defensive, mostly white Christian minority continue to cling to the former. Lately, in the form of Trumpism and the Make America Great Again movement, it was reflected in the prayers and religious symbols participants carried at the U.S. Capitol insurrection, January 6, 2021, and it has become central to the trajectory of the contemporary Republican Party, two-thirds of whom identify as white and Christian. The contemporary white Christian nationalist movement flows directly from a cultural stream that has run through this continent for 5 centuries. In many ways, this truth has always been glaringly apparent. But for those of us who are white and Christian, our precarious position has historically required that we remain vigilantly ignorant of our own origin story while demanding the acquiescence of others. Fragmented narratives demarcate America's Indian problem and Negro problem as distant islands, neither visible from the shores of the other. But if we do the hard work of pushing upriver, we find at the headwaters the white Christian problem. We need a moral imagination that is not amnesiac, one that will hold on to the memory of the systemic injustices that have accrued to black and indigenous people and their forebears. We white Christians no longer represent the majority of Americans. We're no longer capable of setting the nation's course by sheer cultural and political dominance. But there are still more than enough of us to derail the future of democracy in America. Robert P. Jones wrote that and is president and founder of PRRI and the author of The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and The Path to a Shared American Future, from which this essay is adapted. Seven questions. This is the question and answer format, written by Belinda Luscombe, Caitlin Moran, CaitlinMoran, feminist author on the paucity of the patriarchy and the overlooked population addressed in her new book, What About Men? This could be abridged for time constraints, and there are seven questions, beginning with, did writing this book change your mind about men? Answer, if you're a 15-year-old boy in the last 10 years, female empowerment is all you will ever have heard. Their dads know that this is a recent and mild corrective to 10,000 years of patriarchy. The boys just do not have that perspective, and so they are angry. Question, is it true that it's easier to be a woman than a man now? Answer, in one respect, in that we women are able to talk about problems of gender, and men still seem not to have invented that technology in a way that is not damaging, angry, and women blaming. We can confess when we've got a problem. We can talk to each other about it. And then there is this amazing centuries-old thing called feminism that means that even if your mother or your friends do not have the solution, someone has written a blog about it. Someone has written a movie about it. Beyoncé has written a song about it. Men do not seem to have got to that point of being able to go, this scares me. Does anybody else suffer from this problem? Let's form a campaign and bring in legislation that changes our lives forever. Question, you write, the patriarchy is screwing over men as much as women. Is it patriarchy or is it changes in technology and global trade? Answer, I think all men presume they're in the patriarchy and they're winning. No, there's 10 guys at the top of this tree who are doing okay. But you're being F-space CK'd over as well because you're the guy that's scared he's about to be punched when you go to school. You're the one that's been told not to cry. You're the one that does not have paternity leave. Question, to what do you attribute the rise of people like Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate? Answer, the only people who are talking about masculinity at the moment are people like Peterson and Tate. I think the offer of masculinity they make is not only retrogressive and damaging, but simply will not work. I do not know anyone in the world whose anxiety, depression, and unhappiness has been solved by power. What they need is empowerment. I wanted to write a book that encouraged the liberal men to start talking about men again. Question, you advance the theory young boys' fine motor skills set them back emotionally. Can you elaborate? Answer, boys' fine motor skills develop later than girls. So very early on, there is a very negative association for boys with writing and reading. In their teens, they're reading graphic novels, whereas girls are reading stuff about normal lives. Why is there no culture of books about normal boys crossing from childhood to adult? It seems like they need it. Question. You advise young men to make sure sex takes place in a committed relationship. Do you find it surprising that you are aligning yourself with a more traditional view? Answer. My big inspiration for writing that chapter was that young men did not want to talk about the prevalence of sexual assault for teenage girls because it was more worrying to them that they might get falsely accused of rape. You are vanishingly unlikely to be falsely accused of rape. But if this is something you're worried about, then let me give you some very straightforward advice. Make sure your sex partner is someone you trust, that you think is unlikely to start lying about you. Question, what do you think your chances are, as a noted feminist, of getting young men to read your book? Answer, my favorite thing is to find an area that is taboo, difficult, and awkward, and to find a way of starting a conversation where you can blame me. Mums can read this and find a modern, relaxed, humorous, realistic way to talk to their sons about things like violence and extreme online pornography, which are otherwise difficult topics to raise in the middle of Christmas Day. Here's one of those U.S. young people, amazing, that the editor-in-chief talked about. UK, this is UK, Jamie Chadwick challenging The Face of Racing by Anna Gordon. Fewer than 1% of drivers in the history of Formula One have been women. Only 10 women have ever passed the Indy 500 driver's test. But it does not have to be that way, says Jamie Chadwick, one of the world's most accomplished female drivers. Chadwick won the inaugural All-Women W Series in 2019 and took the title twice more before the series was discontinued because of a lack of funding. Today, she's the only female driver in the Indy NXT Developmental League. It is a sport that should be available to men and women to compete equally, says Chadwick, 25. There's very few sports where that is the case. That is not to say men and women are on an even playing field or race course just yet. Racing, Chadwick notes, is a much more physical sport than people realize. Drivers need to possess significant upper body strength to control the car and must withstand the immense G-force experienced at top speeds. It is definitely challenging as a young female driver trying to overcome those physical barriers, she says. In the development leagues, race cars are also designed with the average male driver in mind, from the steering wheel to the distance to the pedals, not for someone like Chadwick, who stands 5'2". One size fits all does not work so well, she says, but perhaps the biggest obstacle to more women entering the sport is a lack of role models. As a young girl, you do not look at it as I can do this because there's no one doing it, she says. I'm a big believer of having more women, not just as drivers, but mechanics and engineers. Still, Chadwick remains hopeful about the future, and she dreams of racing in the IndyCar series and mentoring the next generation. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.